This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. First, let's listen to Trump's buffoonery as he stood amidst the devastation, the ashes, and ruins of people's lives in the town of Paradise, Paradise Lost.
Fire in California. We've been watching this horror unfold before our eyes. President Trump toured the town's hardest hit by fires, including Paradise, a city that, for the most part, has been wiped out. Experts and elected officials say he doesn't really understand what's causing the fire as he continues to blame poor forest management.
I was watching the firemen the other day. So they were raking areas where the fire was right over there, and they're raking trees, little trees like this that are not trees, little bushes that you could see are totally dry, and they're raking them. They're on fire. That should have been all raked out.
What about the argument?
You wouldn't have the fires.
What about the argument it's climate change, that it's drier, it's hotter, and that that's contributing to it?
Maybe it contributes a little bit. The big problem we have is management.
But I'm committed to make sure that we get all of this cleaned out and protected. Got to take care of the floors, you know, the floors of the forests, very important. You look at other countries where they do it differently, and it's a whole different story. I was with the president of Finland, and he said, "I'm much different." He called it a forest nation. And they spend a lot of time on raking and cleaning and doing things, and they don't have any problem.
The president of Finland says he briefed the president recently on his country's forest management, but did not recall mentioning anything about raking. I'm not sure what he was trying to get at, Caddy Kay.
You know, we'll look back and see that one of the great tragedies of this political moment of division is the extent to which climate change has become a victim of that partisanship. And if you are on the side of Donald Trump and his supporters, you will go to the ends of the earth to say that climate change is not responsible for what is happening out in California or other parts of the world at the moment. And if you are a believer in climate change and science, you will try and address that. But the president still says, well, not really, no, tiny bit, hasn't changed his view on climate change. He doesn't really think that's the issue here. Let's get back to raking leaves. Anything other than that, let's address the issue of climate change.
Well, part of the buffoonery is, as he stood there, he consistently called the town, insult to injury, my goodness, he called the town, referred to it as Pleasure, the town of Paradise, totally devastated. A long-awaited report of the federal government, notwithstanding the climate destructionist policies and practices of Trump, has delivered an unmistakable message on climate-fueled disasters. The effects of climate change, including deadly wildfires, increasing debilitating hurricanes and heat waves, are already battering the United States, and the danger of more such catastrophes is worsening and poses a severe threat to Americans' health and pocketbooks, as well as to the country's infrastructure and natural resources. However, the report avoids policy recommendations despite its sense of urgency and alarm.
Now, amidst the potential bankruptcy of the California utility PG&E, whose negligence is believed to have played a role in California's most recent devastating fire, along with three other wildfires across the state in 2017, there is an opportunity for the public to take control of the state's energy destinies. California could serve as a model for other states fed up with the predatory practices of investor-owned utilities and jumpstart a wider shift across the country to democratically controlled renewable energy.
Now to talk about how California's fire-weary public by taking over the commercial utility behemoth, PG&E could cast a vote for climate justice. With us is Johanna Bourgeois, Research Associate at the Democracy Collaborative, which is a really interesting institution which works to carry out a vision of a new economic system where shared ownership and control creates more equitable and inclusive outcomes, fosters ecological sustainability, and promotes flourishing democratic and community life. Johanna, we're very pleased to have you with us. And again, despite the buffoonery of Trump, who can't even care enough to pronounce the name of the area that he is standing in the midst of the ashes and rubbles. Your perspective is that this posits an opportunity to particularly take over PG&E. So why don't we begin by talking about the role of PG&E to begin with, and then, this rather fine idea of nationalizing. And thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Mimi and Ken. Thanks so much for having me. Excited to talk to you all a little bit today, and happy to jump right in, particularly about PG&E's role in the California wildfires. I think for me, it really put in clear relief that California's investor-owned electric and gas utility, PG&E, just isn't suited for the job of managing our energy system. They're at least partly culpable for starting the Camp Fire, which is the one that was the deadliest California wildfire to date, because of electrical problems and really in disinvestment in what we'd call, the grid, so how our energy is transported, and, disinvestment in that infrastructure. And so, and this is not an insulated incident in which this has happened. They've been found to have started 17 fires in 2017. And so there are thousands of residents that are being displaced, sleeping in cars, having lost their belongings, livelihoods. And the California Public Utilities Commission, that does a lot of the regulation of PG&E, is investigating their current safety currently, and have also surfaced this idea of breaking up the large utility. And I would really advocate that we need to go beyond that. We really need to bring our energy utilities into public ownership, because, right now PG&E is operating as what we would call a regulated monopoly. So they have a contract with the state that they have guaranteed rates of return that they can make on, the energy that they're serving to us as customers. But instead of prioritizing building up a resilient grid and investing in safety maintenance, they are focused on, boosting its own corporate profits and paying, executives millions. And so I think that what we can do is shift towards public ownership and really shift, what California wants to be as a climate leader, building a grid that is resilient and deals with the issues of climate change, and building, shifting from a fossil fuel-based extractive economy to one that's environmentally sustainable and, puts the needs and interests of communities first and, really equitably distributes the wealth. Because right now what we're seeing is, this chronic short-termism of PG&E and other utilities, investor-owned utilities like it, that are focused on their shareholders and not the customers of California.
Johanna, one of the things you mentioned in your article on the subject is the possibility of forming community choice aggregations. Could you tell us what that is and how that would be different from what the system is right now?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Actually, I think community choice aggregation is a really good example of something that's already happening in California that shows that community members in California are really hungry for public ownership and being in charge of determining their energy future. Community choice aggregation essentially is when a group of cities, a city or even a county will come together and they take over what we would call kind of the energy procurement process. So PG&E stays in charge of the wires, how your energy is brought into your home and, how it's moved throughout the grid. But then the community choice aggregation takes charge of where that energy is coming from. So is it renewable? Who's actually procuring or who's actually building the infrastructure, and how we are equitably distributing the benefits of renewable energy? And I want to call to attention the Local Clean Energy Alliance, which is a organizing group that's based in the Bay Area that's done incredible amounts of good organizing work on this. And they have created the East Bay Community Choice Aggregation Program that's now been implemented, and they're focusing on, building out renewable energy that's local, it's distributed, they're focusing on building capacities within their own community by building out businesses and renewable energy that's built and provided by local businesses, so that it's actually creating new job markets for folks there. And so this is a really key place where we can start to erode the corporate takeover that PG&E has. But the reality is that PG&E, even with community choice aggregation, is still in charge of these wires and what we would call the grid. And that's what really started the wildfire. So what I'm advocating for in this article is that, we also need to take back the grid. And if we're able to do that, we could actually have, regionalized grids that are publicly owned with then, in addition, community choice aggregation that's happening in a more local way so that cities and counties are in charge of their energy procurement and where that renewable energy is coming from and how the wealth is distributed. I think that we can both continue to have community choice aggregation and take over PG&E and break it up so that it's really our grid is for the public interest and not for corporate shareholder interests.
The groups that actually produce the power in this community aggregations, are they co-ops? Are they owned by the cities or the state, or are they private enterprises?
So it's really a combination right now. I think that particularly in the East Bay, they're thinking a lot through where their energy is coming from and how they can, lift up local jobs and how they can think through, who's in charge of implementing that work. So it's usually a combination. So community choice aggregation, they will likely buy some amount of renewable energy from the market. They might be investing in renewable energy themselves. It might be that they're coming from co-ops and they're helping kind of build out more community solar as well. And I think that in the East Bay, they've identified a certain amount of community energy that they really want to be disseminated across the East Bay area.
One of the things I was thinking about is that aside from PG&E, why don't you start with Con Edison? And why don't you start with Long Island Power? But aside from that, I mean, I've made up my mind quite some time ago on the issue of nationalization of public utilities and so on, despite the fact that we're seeing in places like Puerto Rico and so many others the move towards privatization of all of these things. So within that, the public has been so enculturated over such an extended period of time to be antithetical, to be dismissive at best of public workers, and to feel that the private sphere somehow operates with a greater efficiency. And I'm interested, as somebody who, aside from the PG&E issue, you work with the Democracy Collective, and you're looking at the issue of cooperatives and various forms of nationalization, etc. How do you understand where the public is at, and how do we re-enculturate, if you will, a public to understand the inherent benefit of having the profit motive removed and having a controlling interest in the fundamentals of their lives, such as the utility companies and so on?
Yeah, Mimi, I think you bring up a really good point there that, we have been enculturated. And and there's always this justification for privatization around efficiency. And I think the reality is, public ownership actually, they have proven to be cost effective. Actually, publicly owned utilities have lower costs than most of the investor owned utilities because they actually don't have to, the primary shareholder of these utilities is the community member, it's the customer. And so it actually can lower the rates for them. And even in certain areas that are thinking about public ownership, they've seen that this would be an opportunity for them to lower their rates. And then there's this piece around efficiency. What does efficiency mean? Does it mean, making the biggest bang for your buck and, like, the most profit? Or does it mean that you're actually providing and creating jobs within the local community? Are there options, as we just talked about, for, you know, something like community choice aggregation or public utilities to actually build up local co-ops and local businesses? And, you know, I think that one of the things that's really coming to the fore within utilities is that people are sick of them. They're sick of being stymied at every cross-section, when they can't invest in community solar, when they aren't allowed to, you know, enable net metering. And so it's really a structural issue of these corporate interests that are getting in the way. And so I think we're actually starting to really see a mobilization towards public ownership, because people want to be in charge of their destiny when it comes to climate change and energy and even, like, economic justice and jobs. So, you know, there have been a number. Decorah, Iowa just had a major campaign. There's a long-term campaign in Boulder, Colorado, asking for public ownership. And there are others that are just starting to get off the ground. For instance, the Nationalized Grid campaign that's in Rhode Island going against National Grid. So I think there is an appetite now, and people are starting to realize that, you know, particularly in this context of corporate utilities that are regulated monopolies, that it's not helpful to reaching our goals around climate change. And, you know, we've only got 12 years, and in order for us to rapidly mobilize towards a renewable energy future that also really holds climate justice and puts democracy at the fore and puts equity at the fore, we need to build the institutions that will allow us to do that. And I think that that's really the crux of why I advocate for public ownership of utilities, particularly when we're dealing with something that really is, in many ways, a human right, and it's energy, and it's ensuring that the energy is clean and safe and, you know, the benefits are distributed equitably.
What is the likely impact of public ownership or co-ops on use of renewables? Is that automatic, or is that something that you would hope to educate the public to do?
So one of the things, you know, we have to be clear that moving to public ownership does not mean that we'll get to, you know, that we're immediately at renewable energy. We even have public ownership that's operating right now, and they do have mixed energy. They have coal, they have gas. And so we have to organize around those public utilities that are already in place. But the reality is we have more opportunities to shift, because we, as the customers, have more opportunities for intervention. I'm thinking about the Omaha Public Power District right now. They have an elected board that then determines kind of how the utility operates in Nebraska. And Nebraska is a fully publicly owned state, which is really interesting as well. And they have been able, in the last election that just happened in November, to elect at least two new climate advocates to that board that now are going to steer the direction, and has already started to have implications at the utility. So, you know, renewable energy, no, it's maybe not inherent in moving to public ownership, but because we're building these institutions now, we can actually ensure within charters and by creating more avenues for participation and thinking through, you know, what is the vision for this utility, we can actually bake that in and have more agency on the longer term, in a way that if you have a corporate for-profit utility, or even, let's say, deregulated markets, you don't have that same agency as a community to organize around.
And we're speaking with Joanna Bourgeois, Research Associate at the Democracy Collaborative. And one of the things I'm interested in, I don't know that I want to dance on the bones of PG&E, but at the same time, I mean, they're going to be subject to major litigation, although they survived litigation and two fires that they were involved in the creation of through a negligence in 2017. So Do you think that now there is a particular opportunity that they are on the brink as a result of this, the most devastating fire that has occurred in California, in which they have already acknowledged that they had a role in as to what percentage, along with the various climate issues, who knows? But of course, the climate issues have to go in line with the power grid and the overhead wires. So do you think that they are on their last leg in any event?
Yeah, well, I think they just, you know, are filing recently for, you know, it was the precursor to bankruptcy. And it's really interesting because legislators, you know, got behind them and, you know, wanted to prove to shareholders, oh, we are going to help PG&E get through this by essentially bailing them out. And the way they wanted to bail them out is by offloading the litigation, the potential litigation coming their way from these utility-started fires onto the customers and by like increasing rates. And that has people mad and legislators too, and rethinking, you know, what does it mean to allow PG&E to just dump the cost onto California ratepayers? That, and when, you know, it's them not investing effectively in their infrastructure that got us here in the first place. So I think that we're in this really key moment in which we have the, you know, we have the issue of climate change at the fore of our mind, and we're starting to see the effects and what these corporate interests have done to now, which is, you know, create issues of climate and environmental injustice and have people now, their houses gone. And so I think there's a catalytic moment that we can't miss. And I think that I'm seeing engagement and people consolidating around this issue to a certain degree that could make it potentially possible.
I wanted to ask what's happening with Los Angeles, because they do have a public power system there.
Yeah, and I think LA does have a public power system. Also, SMUD, which is in Sacramento, is another publicly owned utility. They, you know, what I've heard from folks on the ground is that these publicly owned utilities have been more dynamic and have, that it's really been a night and day relationship that they've had between PG&E when they were in those service areas versus, for instance, SMUD or LA. And that these LA, for instance, before what was called, you know, SB 100, which is this 100% renewable energy and electricity that was just passed by Jerry Brown, LA, the mayor asked for a task force to think through how they could get to 100% renewable in about, I think it was 2016. And, you know, they pulled together a group of different stakeholders within the L.A. area to think through that pathway. And so I think that you can see at the, when you have a little bit more of a localized level, you have potentially more engagement, you have more opportunities to hold these utilities accountable. And also, the interesting thing is also that these public utilities, any revenues that they do make, in the case that they do, is reinvested back into the community by it going back to the what we call the general fund. So, like the funds for the city of LA. So that any money that they're making is then transferred and funneled into things like our additional infrastructure, into schools and maybe books and transportation. So it creates, in some ways, a virtuous cycle of creating resiliency in a more systemic way.
You know, SMUD, I love that, SMUD. They actually allow themselves to be called SMUD. But what does SMUD stand for?
I know, it's Sacramento Municipal Utility District. There you go,
SMUD. Way to go, Sacramento. One of the things, particularly I'm interested, since you worked with the Democracy Collective, what you're also talking about here, and I just want to have some opportunity to get in there. I wouldn't say it's exactly the Mondragon model in Spain, etc., but you're certainly advocating for collective, cooperative processes for the people. And I do want you to talk more about that premise One of the great ones that we've seen is, of course, in Jackson, Mississippi, where Cooperative Jackson is working on a series of collective processes and so on. But do talk about that, because that's really one of the elements in here as a mechanism for building a democratic participatory society, using, in this case, the utilities, but you have broader considerations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you really pick out a really great example there of Cooperation Jackson. They are doing incredible work on the ground. And there are other examples of this that's happening. I'll reference a group, One Voice in Mississippi as well, that's also in rural electric cooperative areas, is working to inform and empower particularly Black customers within the area that have been historically cut out of decision-making within within rural electric cooperatives, so that they can actually take the mantle up and start to shift in the direction of more equity and more consideration for their constituencies' needs. So I think that when we're talking about public ownership, we do need to think through what are the systems that are actually going to get us to democracy and equitable democracy and participatory democracy. So I think that there are many models for this. One that stands out to me is having some type of multi-stakeholder model and multi-stakeholder boards in which we have workers and we have customers and we have, you know, potentially elected officials that are all operating on a board of a public utility, so that there are different constituencies that are at the table and making the decisions, so that we know that their perspectives are really held. And, you know, Mondragon is a great example of, you know, how these things are operating and can operate at large scale. Obviously, we have a co-op that we have worked a lot with in the past, which is in Cleveland, Ohio, which is the Evergreen Cooperatives that has operated as a boon to Cleveland, which was a relatively working-class city, and providing really good jobs in which people have agency and opportunity. And we've worked with what we call anchor institutions, so large nonprofit place-based institutions that aren't going to leave, to work on their procurement for things like energy efficiency, for things like laundry and food. So we've worked largely with the medical institution there. And I think that that model could absolutely be applied within public utilities. There's a lot of procurement of energy, and it would make absolute sense to have worker co-ops that are the ones that are actually installing and building out this renewable infrastructure and this renewable vision. And so we can work in concert and to operate and build jobs that are equitable, that have agency and have ownership on multiple levels.
Well, you know, you're creating as much energy as PG&E should have been. Thank you for the article you've written. Thank you for being with us, Joanna Bourgeois. Read her work. Name the article?
PG&E, Don't Break It Up, Take It Over.
Great. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.